David, I thought today's episode was pretty cool with Dr. Lesser, having him talk about sleep issues. It was eye-opening to me and very informative. I mean, he obviously knows his stuff.
Yeah.
Been doing this for a long time. I like that he talked about how we're supposed to work and then kind of how we are working as a society. It's definitely something you and I talk about all the time. We're just not doing things right, and sleep is so important. I think one of the most eye-opening things to me, though, honestly, was that we don't know why we sleep.
Yeah.
All the technology and studies we've done over the years, nobody's figured that out yet. Yet we know all these things happen when we sleep, you know, the rebuilding and of, you know, muscle tears and whatever else that you're doing. If you're working out, that's when you kind of build and grow.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain needs sleep, but nobody's ever pinpointed that. I just kind of thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that was interesting. Just the overall topic, I think it's just an under talked about topic of sleep in general, and people don't give it the importance that it is and how critical sleep is. So I just thought the overall topic was interesting. I thought he brought out a lot of different good points about meditation you can use, or you know, medications and different topics of solutions. So I think it's a great episode.
I agree. I think everybody's going to enjoy it. So today on Healthy Team, Healthy Business Podcast, we're joined by Dr. Jeff Lesser. We asked Dr. Jeff to come with us today because he has a specialty in sleep and sleep science. And so that's something that David and I have been very interested in talking about, and we'd like to bring that topic to our listeners today. So, Jeff, thank you for joining us. I'd like to just start, because I didn't collect this information beforehand, if you could kind of give us a bio and why you're qualified to talk about the stuff that we're going to ask you about today.
Sure. So I am a medical doctor. I did my initial 3 years of training in internal medicine, and then did a 3-year fellowship training in pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine. So I'm currently board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, all 3 of those specialties.
Okay, good. Well, thanks for coming out today. We greatly appreciate it. So David and I both have, you know, a workforce in some sort of in a manufacturing industry where we're trying to push hard to find ways to help our workforce find their way to health and wellness. And we believe that sleep is definitely a component of that. In our individual studies, we both found ways to improve our own sleep and make sure that's an important part of it. So just curious, as a place to start, what do you think, or what do you know about how prevalent sleep issues are out there in the workforce and in the population in general?
So it really sort of depends on what you define as a sleep issue.
Right? Okay.
So if you're asking for the prevalence of something like obstructive sleep apnea, that's somewhere between 4% and 9% of the population.
Okay.
If you're asking about insomnia, so the definition of insomnia would be difficulty falling asleep or difficulty maintaining sleep. Throughout the course of the year, about 40% of the population will have some complaints of insomnia, right? And so we can talk big or we can talk little. We can talk about the fact that our society is now a 24/7, 365 thing, which really messes up everybody's innate circadian rhythms. And so it can be a huge issue, and most people throughout the course of the year will experience problems. You know, as I get older, I have a harder time with daylight savings time. I don't know if you've noticed that it's, you know, so there are two things that make you sleep. The longer you've been awake, and that's called sleep pressure. And so you stay awake for 16 hours, you want your 8 hours of sleep. But you take that nap too close to bedtime, it's hard to fall asleep, you've lost a lot of that sleep pressure. Or another example would be, you know, you go to bed at 10, but you wake up at 2, you have a harder time falling back to sleep because you slept for 4 hours, you've lost that sleep pressure.
Okay.
But then the other one is your circadian rhythm. And your circadian rhythm is entrained by sunlight. So when you wake up and the sun's shining, that blue sky hits your eyes and your melatonin levels drop. And your melatonin levels stay low until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You want to take that little siesta, that little 30-minute nap. And then they go back down, but then when the sun goes down, your melatonin levels start to rise until it makes you sleepy. They continue to rise until 2 hours before you wake up, and then they start to drop. You wake up and they plummet. And so part of the issue that we're having is with the 365, with the great screen resolution on your phone, on your iPad, with the new daylight light bulbs, those really are tricking your brain to not make the melatonin and can screw up your circadian rhythm. And so that's one of the things that we see with shift workers. And there's a lot of research going into why are shift workers more at risk for cardiovascular health problems, for cancer. Because if you account for everything, they have a much higher rate of mortality, your night workers. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, we can talk about any or all of those things.
Well, that's a lot to unload on. But that's what's really is fascinating with sleep and with the whole topic of health in general. But do you see, I mean, obviously that it'd be hard to go back into the, say, early 1900s, maybe when that 365 didn't exist or shift work didn't exist. So the one extreme of going back to normal light bulbs or dropping your cell phone or blue light blocking lenses. And what are people's options then? Or what are some solutions to...
Well, I think the average person needs between 7 and 8 hours of sleep. Some people need more, some people need less, but that's the average. It is setting your sleep routine, right? Picking what time you want to go to bed and relatively sticking with it. About 30 minutes before your desired bedtime, TV goes off, phone goes off, you start winding down, prayer, meditation. You try to get rid of those pressured thoughts. So when it's time to go to bed, you can go to bed. Sleep is supposed to be easy, but when you find that it's not, that becomes frustrating. So we want to get the brain ready to fall asleep. And then you get up at relatively the same time every day. You try to get some light if you can and maintain that sleep cycle as best you can. I mean, we all have, a late night here or there, but if you can maintain a relative sleep routine, that's the easiest thing that you can do.
So where would you start with somebody if they were having an issue and they're saying, I've got the insomnia, maybe you're looking at their diet or you're looking at their sleep condition? I mean, what do you start to address with that? Or
so the first thing we use is it's something called a sleep log. And, it's a piece of graph paper, and every day what time did they go to bed? What time did they wake up? When did they have exercise? When did they watch TV, caffeine, and you try to track what they're doing, okay? So I saw a lovely woman today whose complaint was she can't fall asleep. Well, she goes to bed at 9 p.m., and she says it takes her 3 hours to fall asleep, okay? Well, she goes to bed, she falls asleep at midnight, and I said, what happens then? Well, I wake up at 8, and I feel okay. Well, you shouldn't be going to bed at 9, right? So it's what is your routine? Society believes that we should be 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., right? Well, there's plenty of people that's not their norm. They want to sleep 3 a.m. to 11. That works for me if it works for their job, their boss, and they don't have an 8 a.m. appointment. So it really is figuring out what their innate sleep cycles should be, and then figuring out what the pressures are to get them where that having some issues, and can you fix that, right? And then if you can't, then you figure out what we have to do to make that better. Is it an intrinsic sleep problem, right? Is it sleep apnea? Are there medications that may help? Can we reduce some triggers in their life to make it easier for them to sleep?
And what health conditions, you mentioned about the shift workers having the higher mortality rates. Is there a way you can correlate sleep issues to health issues, like larger health issues? I mean, you're a cardiopulmonary guy, so can you say that sleep issues can lead to that alone could lead to heart issues, or is it that in combination with maybe some other poor lifestyle choices?
So the easiest to talk about would be obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay.
So obstructive sleep apnea means the airway relaxes too much and impairs your breathing. We measure the average number of events per hour. Normal would be less than 5 events per hour. 15 to 30 is moderate. 30 or more would be severe. Moderate and severe obstructive sleep apnea, regardless of all other health conditions, increases your risk for stroke, high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, and funny heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation. treating it and continually treating it reduces those risks by about 25 to 40%.
Okay.
So having, we don't know why we sleep, right? Like no one's ever really figured that out, but a lot of stuff happens when we sleep. And so having that continual sleep, that 7 to 8 hours of sleep, is really necessary for overall health.
So sleep apnea and insomnia, have those numbers, has any tracking been done on that? I mean, it seems like everything is climbing. If it's autism or if it's sleep apnea, is there any correlation to, again, those types of things of why those are climbing? Are we just keeping better data, or is there indeed an issue?
Well, I think it's much easier to get the diagnosis of sleep apnea. You know, when you did a sleep study 20 years ago, you know, there were limited locations. Not everybody bought into that it mattered. So, you know, now you can do a sleep study at home. So it's much easier to make that diagnosis. But I'd also say that the size of the population, the expanding waist size of our population, with weight being probably the number one risk factor for sleep apnea, makes it much more prevalent. But I'd also say that, you know, when we say sleep apnea can cause atrial fibrillation or a funny heart rhythm, then the cardiologists are on the lookout for it, so we're doing more studies. So since they're doing more studies, you're going to catch more of the population. But the incidence, or I guess I should say the prevalence of sleep apnea, is increasing. And then I think there is a focus on overall health. And so people are recognizing that sleep is important. So people are asking a lot more questions about what they can do and is this normal or what are my options. So I think there's a little bit more of a focus on it as well.
And then I wanted to talk about the testing, or the diagnostics exercise, because I had a sleep study done. You did that for me way too long ago now, but I, you know, I went to a facility, you know, and they hooked me up all the stuff. There was a bed, and I was like, it was like I was in a bedroom. I mean, it was trying to simulate, you know, a sleeping environment. But I, you know, I follow a lot of health and nutrition people on podcasts and stuff like that, so I kind of geek out on some of that stuff. But a lot of them have tracking devices where they're tracking their own sleep, you know, with wearables, mm-hmm. or whatever. I'm just curious how the testing methodology has changed since you've been kind of doing this in your career.
Yeah, so I'm old enough to say that, you know, we used to have these reams of paper where we would look at the brainwave activity. You'd have to scroll through, you know they were 18 inches by, you know, 10 feet long throughout the course of the night. You have to go through. So now that everything is computer recorded, it's much easier. But the big change is that we can do most of our testing at home.
Okay.
So there really is, for an adult patient not on oxygen, that doesn't have heart failure, there's not a good indication to do an in-lab study for obstructive sleep apnea anymore. So most of these things should be able to be done at home. Now, the caveat to that is sleep is a brainwave activity. So we see significant changes in patterns in brainwave activity. And so we need that to say that's sleep. So any of the home sleep studies or the wearables, they're much more about actigraphy, which is activity, temperature, movement, those sorts of things. And they use a fancy algorithm to correlate that. So when you have these rings, they basically say you haven't moved. If you lay perfectly still, heart rate slows down, temperature cools down, it may say that's sleep. You can fool it if you want. I don't know why you would want to. So the home sleep studies, I can't guarantee you're asleep. So when you look at them, they'll have recording time, monitoring time, oxygen time. It tries to use that algorithm to estimate sleep.
Okay.
And so everything is moving towards the home because it's just so much easier. You know, the studies have shown that the average person needs 3 nights in a new environment to be as comfortable as they're at home. And then once you know, what it's called the Hawthorne effect, once you start measuring something, you screw everything up anyway. Right? And so we know that it's not a normal night's sleep. But if we can do it at home in your own environment, people are happier, they're more comfortable, and it's also a heck of a lot cheaper.
Right.
Are you seeing any, you said you had mentioned about medications. I mean, is that a common need or solution, or is, you know, you addressed a couple different things. What, you know.
So when we talk about obstructive sleep apnea, that is a structural problem, so there aren't any medications on the market for it currently. When we talk about the other sleep issues, things like insomnia or circadian rhythm disorders, there are medications that can help. But to be clear, there is no medication that improves sleep quality, right? Any medication that I give you makes it easier for you to fall asleep and stay asleep, but I can't make 6 hours of sleep feel like 8 hours of sleep. I can't improve the quality of sleep. I can decrease your arousal threshold, right? So we've all had too much alcohol, makes us feel sleepy, but we don't wake up feeling good, right? And so we don't really have those kind of medications yet.
Is there any crossover into the workplace with those medications causing issues safety-wise? I mean, I know if someone comes here with not enough sleep, then they could be an issue. Could it also be an issue if they took it too late in the evening and now?
Absolutely, right? So probably the most common sleep medication on the market is Ambien. And 3 or 4 years ago, the FDA decreased the recommended dosage for women because of residual fatigue. There was too much grogginess, and there was drowsy driving in their accident. So they went from the dose of 10 milligrams down to 5 milligrams. So that's whenever I give somebody a medication for sleep, we always talk about having to find the right time to take the medication so they're not having side effects the next day. So that's a huge concern, right? That, you know, half of the medications on the market anymore say, you know, be careful when using heavy equipment, you know. And so, absolutely, you got to be worried about some of these medications causing problems.
Is there any thoughts that you have maybe for a business owner or a team leader on how they could be proactive on, I mean, marijuana is easy, you do a drug test. I mean, how do you help with something that's been prescribed? And
so I'd argue marijuana is not easy, right? I mean, this is the hard part. There's some interesting studies talking about marijuana improving sleep. But if I smoked last night, I'm not high the next day. I'm good to go. I mean, the drug test says that I've used within the past 30 days. So you have an alcohol test that theoretically corresponds to the fact that you're inebriated. We don't have a test that says that you're high, right? So we, you know, I guess, you know, I can talk about the medications and their side effects. I can't really talk about the employer's access to that knowledge and knowing that their employee's on some medication. All I can say is it's really important to be aware of the drowsy employee, the distracted employee, and trying to figure out why, right? I mean, there's not a good test for that. I mean, we have some tests for that, but you have to figure out when they're appropriate for that person. So
I'm kind of wanting to think about some of the stuff you said earlier about different people might have a different kind of sleep pattern. And I'm curious, a couple of things. One, are those things established at like childhood? You know, so if you grew up in a family where that everybody's got a 9-to-5 job, everybody kind of has this, like you said, the 10-to-6 kind of sleep pattern. But if someone notices at some point in their life that they function better, like your patient that sleeps from 12 to 8, like great. I guess somehow you got to figure out how to take action on that. And what is that action? Is it adjust the rest of my life so that my sleep is appropriate, or adjust my sleep, and then how big of a hill is that to climb?
So we're talking about the innate circadian rhythm, right? So before we went on, we were talking about our kids. So the babies are sleeping 20 out of 24 hours a day, right? And that kind of narrows down. when they hit, you know, so a 6 to a 12 year old should be sleeping 10 to 11 hours per day. When they hit their teenage years, it's interesting that circadian rhythm shifts later. So they want to stay up later and they want to sleep longer into the day. So I live in Frederick County, but my kids go to Sacred Heart. But I think the Winchester schools, I think the younger kids go to school earlier than the older kids, right? So, I mean, it's much more likely that a first grader wants to be at school at 7:30 than a teenager wants to be at school at 7:30. And so you always, if you pay attention, there's always this push about when people should be sleeping. So that varies throughout the course of your life, okay? But we all have friends that are night owls that want to be up later. I mean, that's sort of an innate thing that you just are that way. Can you change it? Yes. Some things are easier to do than others. Meaning, it's always easier if you're somebody who wants to go to bed at 5 p.m. and sleep until 2, that's easier to change than it is for the people that want to go to bed at 3 a.m. and sleep till 9, because you're always trying to push forward, okay? So if you want to stay up later, being exposed to bright light is the way to go. And so on a different subject, if you've ever heard of seasonal affective disorder, you're supposed to get a light box, and that helps reduce that. And so this light box, which are $50 on Amazon, you know, are basically really bright lights that have that blue wavelength that we're looking for, that can push your sleep either direction depending upon when you want it. So if you want to stay up later, using this light box can really push you. But it's really hard to push somebody from 3 a.m. to 11 p.m., right? That becomes a much more difficult thing to do. Right? Just like when you travel cross country, it's easy to go to the West Coast. It's hard from the West to go to the East. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a more entrained form of jet lag.
And then a kind of a different place, but is there a correlation between or a way to compare, let's say, a drunk driver with a sleepy driver? Or is there data on that?
Absolutely. And so one of the populations we see a lot of are people that have CDLs.
Right.
So a commercial driver's license, and the Department of Transportation has recognized this fact. Yeah. And if you meet certain criteria, which is typically a neck size and a BMI, body mass index, if you're over certain areas, you have to do a sleep study, right? So the technical question is you have to prove that you don't have sleep apnea. The only way you can do that is by doing the sleep study. And so they figured out that the number one cause of single vehicle accidents was drowsy driving. And whether it's because they're up too late and driving too long, so that's why they're always checking the log books to see what they're doing, or because your concentration is affected because you're tired. But absolutely, drowsy driving is as bad, I shouldn't say as bad, can be a huge problem.
Yeah, that's we employ commercial drivers, so I know, unfortunately, know a lot about that over the years. I mean, it always happens too. Somebody will go for their next update and they're like, oh, your neck measurement's X, so unless you want to, they'll give you a 3-month provisional, but you got to get this sleep study done.
And just to get the CDL, they'll check your neckline and your waistline.
Mm-hmm. They measure your neck. Yeah.
Yep. So the idea is, with we're worried about obstructive sleep apnea, the muscles of the airway collapse too much and block that passage. And so as your neck gets bigger, it doesn't get bigger just out, it gets bigger both ways, so that airway can be easier to collapse. And so for men, circumference greater than 16.5 inches, for women 15.5 inches, increases your risk of sleep apnea. And so they being the Department of Transportation, cast a very wide net and said, if your BMI is over a certain thing or your neck's over a certain thing, prove to us that you don't have sleep apnea. They don't ask questions about, are you tired, have you had accidents, whatever. They're basically saying, because of your body size, whatever. And is it right? I'm not in the policy business. The problem is when you ask somebody if they're tired, and they're going to answer that based upon their employment status. That becomes, are they telling the truth? Are they motivated to tell the truth? Because they're trying to keep getting the paychecks and put food on the table.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And one question I was just curious about is, has any of the, the way we sleep has shifted a lot over the last 100 years in either the MyPillow or Purple Mattress. And, do any of those things, are they improving it? Or, we follow other people. I follow like Liver King or some of the other guys that they want a wood bed and they want a soft, like a rollout and that's it. And they say that's the best. The blue lights, like you had talked about, they don't want any of that in their bedrooms. And obviously that's one extreme, but can you speak at all to that aspect of?
Yeah. So when we talk about adults, we talked about the babies, it's always back to bed. They don't sleep on their stomach. As soon as you have enough muscle control to roll over, position is whatever you are most comfortable in. There's never been a study saying there's a certain type of mattress that works better than another at preventing sleep problems. So it's whatever. Sleep is supposed to be easy. We want it to be easy, so whatever makes you most comfortable. Now, that being said, there are some environmental factors. The bedroom should be for sleep and for sex. It is not for laying on the bed, doing homework, doing taxes, reading a book. Your brain will associate the bed with that. So you want, that's all you really should be doing in there. So you really shouldn't have a TV in the bedroom if you can help it. It needs to be dark, right? You don't want any sort of external stimulation if you can help it. So the night workers, the day sleepers, they really need to get as much as they can the light blocking shades so they don't have that. When you sleep, your body temperature drops a couple degrees. And so if the room is comfortable during the day, it may actually be a little bit too warm for you to sleep at night. And so you might want to drop that temperature a little bit or have some circulating air so you just feel more comfortable. And so those are the things that we talk about, sleep hygiene, which is getting the TV out of the room, trying to avoid the alarm clocks, right? Because somebody will roll over and look and say, now they have 3 more hours of sleep. you want to be able to sleep. You want to make it cool, peaceful, relaxing. There are some environmental factors. I don't know that sleeping on a wood... if it's comfortable for your back, I'm not going to tell you not to, because pain 100% can interrupt your sleep.
What would you recommend if you said no alarm clock? I don't keep my phone, or I try not to keep my watch, but what would you do then? On
when I say no alarm clock, I don't want you to have the big red numbers that wake up to go to the bathroom and you see that it's 5:30. Then you're, my alarm's going off in 45 minutes, and you have a little bit of frustration, right? So, there's a big push to getting your phone out of the bedroom so you can't do anything on it. But having it upside down and letting it chime or putting it across the room so you can't reach over and grab it, those would be things. But, you just don't want to be fixated on the time.
I got you.
I guess what I should have said.
Yeah, I think you talked about that earlier. Just the mental game of sleep is big. And if you can kind of eliminate all that stuff, that's one less factor you got to worry about. I was curious just about when somebody comes to see you, is it because they're pretty far gone? Like they've had sleep issues for weeks, months, or whatever? Are they referrals because another doctor is worried about them, maybe because of obstructive sleep apnea or something like that? Just curious why someone ends up in your office and what their condition is when they get there.
So it's probably 50-50. Half are going to be a different provider wants to make sure sleep apnea isn't causing the problem that they're trying to treat.
Okay.
Whether it's a cardiologist or one of our bariatric surgeons, because untreated sleep apnea increases some of the post-op risks. The other large population is going to be the bed partner, right?
Okay.
It's going to be the husband or wife saying, he snores, he stops breathing, it bothers my sleep, I'm worried that he's never going to wake up. Those will be the two things. So it'd be you know, worried about sleep. So it's most of the time the patients aren't coming in saying, I need help because of this. It's my wife says, you know, I snore, or she's kicked me out of the bedroom. Right. How do I get back in there? Those sorts of things.
That's how I ended up finding out I had, because I never had any idea. I was perfectly fine. It turns out that I wasn't. So we had what somebody called a sleep divorce. So we're happily married, but we just, you know, a lot of times don't end up in the same bed. So works out good.
I really like to meditate, and I thought it was interesting you had talked about meditation can be a key. Is there a certain, I like to do TM. Is there a certain type of meditation, or is it a breathing technique, or that you would recommend, or that people can try on that?
I think it really truly is whatever works for you. Right. So, the one that we always talk about, which is easy, is some guided meditation, because you can find some apps online very easily that sort of take you on. Yeah. And it just takes your mind off the daily activities and allows your brain to start shutting down. So you're ready for sleep.
How about timing of food? Like, so one thing I'm really anal about is I don't ingest any calories somewhere between 2 and 3 hours before I know I'm going to go to bed. And that works very well for me. I don't wake up. I feel, you know, feel rested and all that kind of stuff. Same thing with even drinking water. I'll stop drinking water sometimes an hour or two before bed, just to make sure I don't wake up, especially as I'm getting older. So I'm just curious what your experience has been with any of that, or what studies say about any of those kind of practices.
So the food one is, you know, you don't want to go to bed hungry, right? Because you don't want hunger pains trying to, you don't want to be so full or bloated that you're uncomfortable. You don't want to increase your risk of acid reflux that can interrupt your sleep. But as far as the timing, that's sort of up to you.
Okay.
Biggest one is caffeine. So people will say, I can drink coffee and still fall asleep. And that's true, but it does impair your ability to hit the more restful stages of sleep, the slow wave sleep that you need. And the average half-life for caffeine is somewhere around 8 hours. So we really want to minimize caffeine before that. Alcohol helps you fall asleep, but it doesn't help you stay asleep. And as you go through the alcohol withdrawal throughout the course of the night, it really impairs your ability at the restful stages of sleep. So alcohol is something else to watch out for. Guys, you know, as we get older, prostate becomes an issue. So if getting up and going to the bathroom is a problem, then you do try to minimize some of your liquid intake before bed.
And I was just wondering about that too. I guess it would be kind of an extreme example, but if someone was doing that, would like being dehydrated cause you to wake up, or cause you to not be able to restfully sleep as bad as like a hunger
pain? If you're dehydrated, your body's going to crave water.
Okay.
Right? You're going to, you know, so the basic idea is you want to make your body ready for sleep. And so you need to take care of whatever those sort of basic needs are before you get into bed. Otherwise, it will prevent you from hitting the more restful stages of sleep.
Okay. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I
just enjoyed the whole topic and think it's a undervalued or underthought of kind of topic. So,
I mean, if you think about it, you're going to sleep for 40%+ of your life, right? You know, you sleep a lot when you're a baby, and you kind of sleep a little bit more as you hit your golden years. It should be easy. It should be refreshing. I do think that it's underappreciated and undervalued, but it never should be a problem. And when it's a problem, that's when you got to figure out what that is.
Yeah, I agree. I think in this 24/7 society that we live in, and the sort of the American spirit of work, we have this drive to think, well, if I only slept for 4 hours a night, I could get so much more done. But the idea is that, man, you're really digging yourself a hole. At some point, it's just going to crumble.
Yeah, there are people who only need 4 hours of sleep, right? There are 100% people that need 4 hours, and there's some that need 9 or 10. I mean, but the average needs between 7 and 8 hours of sleep. And there was an interesting study that the person who slept on average less than patients, people who slept for less than six or people who slept for more than 10, the mortalities on those two ends were higher, right? And I'm not saying that it's a sleep problem, right, but it's probably indicative of the other things that are going on. I always tell my patients, you're not a sleep camel. You don't get to sleep for 6 hours Sunday through Thursday and then catch up. You can't ever really make up for that sleep deficit. You can get those 8 hours of sleep, more if you need it, more if you're sick, but you can't. You don't get to sleep for 10 hours on Saturday night and say that saved me for whatever. Or yeah, the people who work 36 hours on and 12 hours off, that's just, it's going to catch up with you.
Yeah, agreed. Well, this is an interesting topic, Jeff. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure.
It's been fun and something we haven't talked about yet in depth on this podcast. So it's a great topic and something that Dave and I will definitely be paying attention to.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming along with us for another episode of the Healthy Team, Healthy Business podcast. We'd love for you to follow us on Instagram at Healthy Team, Healthy Biz. That's B-I-Z. You can also find us on Facebook under the same name. You're welcome to send us a message on either one of those applications, or you can send us an email directly at teamdudes@healthyteamhealthybusiness.net. We'd love to hear your feedback and requests you might have for topics or guests. Please feel free to send them our way. If you would take the time to give us a rating or a feedback on your favorite podcast app, that would also be much appreciated and quite helpful. Thanks again for following along and sharing your passion for health with all of us.